Welcome to Functional Divorce, your guide to healing and happiness. I'm Dr. Karen Finn. Remember when you very first started to date, how much fun it was and how exciting it was to call up your friends and talk to them about everything that was going on, and they tell you what was going on in their love life, and you could just really kind of figure out what it meant to date someone, to be in a relationship, to kind of figure out what it was like to go on to the next phase of becoming an adult. But when you get divorced and you try to enter the dating world, it's an entirely different scene. Because for most of us, when you get divorced, your friends are still your friends from when you were married, and most of them are married. So you're left wondering, what's going on? Is this relationship working? Is it not working? What's he really mean when he says this? What's she really mean when she says that? It can just all be a great big mess. So where do you turn to get the lowdown on what a mature single person thinks about dating? Well, I have to tell you, my guest today, Dr. Charles Rawling, has written a book called It Really Is That Complicated. And he gives you the lowdown on what a mature single male thinks about dating. After all, he's been there, he's done that, and he's not afraid to tell you what dating is all about. Dr. Charles Rawling, as I mentioned, is the author of It Really Is That Complicated. The interesting thing is that before he was an author, he had a career as a prominent neurosurgeon and is now an attorney. His practice of Rawling's firm caters primarily to clients who have been injured by medical malpractice. Dr. Rawlings, thank you so much for being here to talk about your book, It Really Is That Complicated.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Karen. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Well, thank you. I really am curious.
Okay.
To know, what is it that prompted you to write this book?
Oh, yes. What prompted me to write this book? Well, interestingly, it was written, obviously, after my divorce. Mm-hmm. And I entered into the dating world, which, since I had been married, I believe it was 17, 18 years, I had not been in for a while, and encountered all sorts of strange and unusual behavior and creatures and everything else like that. And so I was talking to some of my friends that accompanied me and my side after the divorce, and was talking to them about some of my experiences, some of my thoughts about it, what some of the women, which occasionally just blew my mind, did or said or didn't do. And they were like, look, what you're saying is absolutely true. But instead of telling us, why don't you write a book about it?
Uh-huh.
You're articulate. You've got interesting viewpoints. Some of it's going to be controversial. But it's going to be an interesting piece of literature out there for people to either respond to or learn from or at least enjoy. And so I took that in consideration and thought about it for a while and decided to write the book. And I sat down with three good friends over a weekend, and we came up with the chapters and almost came up with the chapter headings. And after that, I tried to write a chapter a month and just put it into press.
Wow. So it really was I want to say that it was kind of a little bit of peer pressure that encouraged you to get moving on this.
Well, I don't know that. I mean, if you knew me, it's hard to see me being pressured by peer pressure, but it was encouragement. It was like, you know, go ahead, just write it, spew it out. It's, you know, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be controversial, but you've got some points that that are very valid.
Right, right. Well, you know, Your mention of if I knew you, I'd find it kind of hard to believe that you could be subject to peer pressure. And I have to say, honestly, that came out in the book.
One
of the themes that was obviously there was, you know, if you're only going to do what society expects of you, how are you going to know if you're really as happy and productive and fearless as you could possibly be?
Absolutely. That's one of my points that you just talked about is you cannot, it's not necessarily conforming to society, but you've got to do your own, I guess, sort of cliched, but do your own thing, think your own thoughts, and not be afraid of bucking societal trends. I mean, it's, you don't need the two kids picket fence, you know, in suburbia to be happy. And there is a lot of societal pressure to have that sort of goal in mind, or even a goal just to get married, or even a goal to have a significant other. It's okay to be single.
Yeah, it is totally okay to be single. And, you know, I always kind of think of living the way that society expects of you as living in a box. It's kind of confining.
It's extraordinarily confining, believe me.
So one of the things that I know you did to step out of that box, right, was to write this book. Because lots of people talk about being willing to write a book, you know, oh, I've had all these great experiences, I should write a book. But so few people did. So thank you very much for, you know, stepping outside of the box and putting this out there for us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you very much for that. I have another one out, which is totally different than this, and I'm also gotten three others in. Well, one is in, at the publishers now, and so we've got two others that are coming out. But it's they're all unique, and writing is definitely a creative outlet. It's an interesting way to create things.
Well, I think that creativity is one of the basic drives that we all have as human beings. And so few people embrace that. And what really fuels creativity, I think, for me and for most of the people that I've talked to about this, and I'm going to be interested to get your opinion on this, is to have new experiences.
I would not disagree with that at all. It's certainly a way to broaden your horizons, to have new experiences. And if you can take the new experiences and the education therefrom and warp them into creativity, then that is definitely a part of growing.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to what really this book is about in trying to figure out relationships. And I know that you start the book by talking about the pull that men and women have toward each other. And I'd really like for you to tell us about what you believe the primary drives are for men and women to come together.
Wow, that's an interesting question, because there's so many layers.
Mm-hmm.
First, I think, and I'm probably can't label these as most important, least important, but at least first, overall, I think there is societal pressure. Trying to get a couple or couples together from a societal standpoint, it's looked down, and many of the functions of society are not geared to single folks.
Mm-hmm.
Even going out to dinner alone, some people, you know, get weird looks when you sit down alone without someone else, especially women, I know.
Yeah,
even as a male. So first, there's society driving couples together, whether it's male-female, male-male, female-female. It doesn't make any difference. It's not good to be alone in this society, unlike some of the other societies out there in the world. Then I think you have the individual personal motivations. Mm-hmm. And much of that comes from some of the baggage that you bring in from your childhood, from your other relationships, from your self-esteem aspects. And many people just don't like themselves being alone. They feel that they are not as fulfilled, or they need some, you know, like, you complete me, some nonsense like that.
Yeah.
And they feel less of a person in terms of not being able to sustain a relationship with another person from a permanent standpoint. And I think that's seriously what drives a lot of people, is they feel unfulfilled and they feel less of a person if they're not in a relationship.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and I like the language that you used in the book, that for a lot of men, they have a drive to fix.
Absolutely, and that is part of their overall motivation in terms of finding a mate or finding someone there, is mm-hmm. they do want to fix things.
Right.
Especially when they're in a relationship, they see themselves, or at least most alpha males see themselves as a fixer. Oh, and sometimes that clouds and overrides much of what's in the relationship itself. But yeah, as a fixer, that's what they want. Absolutely.
Right. And then from the standpoint of women, one of the premises of the book is that they're really searching for security and to have children, to be able to nurture.
Absolutely. And that is somewhat of an age-dependent idea. Obviously, mm-hmm. Older women aren't so much fixated on children. Many times they've had children, or they don't want children, or they decided something along that lines, but they definitely want to nurture, and they definitely want security, which goes back to they see themselves as less complete without a male. And I'm sure there are many, many women that are now screaming in horror about this, which is perfectly okay, but
yeah.
Most people, most women, and I'd even lump this with males, they don't feel complete without someone else. They feel like a failure.
Yes. Now, failures, one of the big things that when someone gets divorced, they have to deal with. So many of us have a tendency to feel like failures ourselves instead of being able to look at the marriage and say, the marriage was a failure.
Absolutely. And they take it personally, which I'm sure that there's a fair share of, quote, blame to go around if you want to use blame.
Yeah.
Or it just could be that people grow apart, but mm-hmm. you're absolutely right. They don't see it as the partnership failing, which partnerships, businesses, whatever, they fail all the time. They see this as a personal affront in terms of, I wasn't good enough to satisfy my partner, and thus
right.
they left.
Right. Right. Or, you also see the other side of the coin with them blaming their partner. They weren't good enough to satisfy me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they have blinders on and they can't see. It's like, well, yeah, I cheated on him or I cheated on her, but that's not my fault. She made me do it.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, I don't think she made you go out and have an affair. Yeah. Just somehow I don't think that happened.
Yeah, so. there's that little thing, a personal responsibility, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, one of the things that I found intriguing in chapter 2 was the idea that men are frightened to make long-term commitments.
I would say the majority of men probably are. It's an interesting conundrum as to why.
Yeah.
It may stem from mother issues all the way back from childhood, but it also may just be that they don't want to get in a long-term committed relationship and something better come along.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in their sort of clouded mind, they may not know exactly what better, best, good is, and they just go from moment to moment trying to satisfy whatever it is at the present time. I always see a relationship somewhat, and I talk about this in the book, as mm-hmm. sort of a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah.
It's like, you're not going to get perfect, and I was always taught that better is the enemy of good. And, I mean, you just can't get perfect. There's always going to be something. And sure, you can go from relationship to relationship bouncing around and have, oh, well, in this relationship I didn't have this, but in this mm-hmm. relationship I did have this, but wow, I didn't have that. And you
yeah.
can go through life, for decades doing that.
Yeah, you definitely can. Well, now here's something that I was really interested in learning your opinion on, because this idea of not wanting to commit for men because something better might come along, is that something that is part of a younger man's persona as well as a more mature male's persona,
Oh, I don't think there's any question that it's way more prevalent in the younger guys, especially these days. These days, the younger generations, and I'm not saying this disparagingly at all, have grown up with the internet, with social media, with about a one-minute time span, and instead of fixing something, you throw it away or you get rid of it. Whereas, you know, if you were married in the 50s, you would stay together and fix problems.
Right.
And while that may have led to unhappy marriages, you definitely got to know the person and worked on problems together. Here, the younger generation is like, you know, I can bounce from one bed to another, and I don't even have to commit to anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very interesting to see how the different generations respond to different things. And you see it in more than just relationships, right? You see it in just the way they relate to the world, as you were kind of alluding to with the shorter attention spans that people seem to have. You know, they also read less quickly than what they used to.
Absolutely. And a lot of it is media driven, the internet and the social media. You know, it's like 1 or 2 minute sound bites, not even that, 30 seconds, just flashing images. And instead of, you know, taking a week to read a book, you take 30 seconds to read some blurb up on the internet. And that fuels this, I can bounce from one thing to another and not have to work on it. I don't have to commit. I don't have to become involved. And I don't have to become deeply ingrained or educated as to what I'm doing.
Right, right. And yet, that's one of the things that you really try to paint in the book is a constant education, right? Every one of the adventures or dates that you had, right, you present it with a, and this is what came of it, and this is what I thought about it. So
absolutely. I mean, the education with some of my encounters and experiences was invaluable, and it was, many of them were just highly amusing to me.
Yeah. that definitely comes across.
I'm now, like, really? Okay.
But you know, that's part of discovering who we are and what we like and what works for us and what doesn't work for us, you know, as we reenter the dating world after divorce.
Absolutely. And you've got to have a good attitude about it. You can't go out there after having been in either a marriage or a long-term relationship and expect everything to be perfect the first time.
Yeah.
You're going to have to view this as, I'm sort of loath to use the word experiment, but that's really what you're doing, because the person has to understand that they are a changing person, that they have to relearn who they are, and the first couple times probably isn't going to be exactly what they're looking for.
Yeah. And actually, I love the word experiment. It's the word I use all the time with the people I talk to about, you know, going back out into the dating world, because somehow it takes the pressure off.
Okay, well, yeah, it's a perfect word. There's no question about that. Some people just recoil with the word, well, I'm not experimenting, I'm out there for real. Well, okay, but fine, how's this real working for you? Last couple of times it sounded like an experiment to me.
Yeah, you know, when you're out there for real, it had such an intensity to it that can really color everything. Whereas if you're willing to be out there and learn, right, which is what an experiment is all about, I think the outcomes are so much better. At least they were for me.
I agree. But, you know, when you get to that intensity, you see the fact that this is real. This is intense. I'm dating. I'm like, well, okay, why? Because society tells you, or you need someone. You're not comfortable with yourself. You feel like a failure. Why does it need to be so intense?
Yeah.
Not everyone's going to work out for you.
No, they're definitely not. And it's not like a job, you know, where you're going to get a pay raise or a bonus, you know, for working your little tail off.
Absolutely not. Nope. And you do not get a medal for dating 6 times a week.
Nope. You get tired.
You get tired.
Well, so I thought it was very interesting that you shared that some of your dating adventures came about by way of working with matchmakers.
Absolutely, yeah.
How did you choose to work with matchmakers?
I am a fairly unique person with fairly unique ideals. I don't meet the conservative sort of put me in a box type male. In fact, it was interesting. I did an article for the Wall Street Journal where we talked about this very thing, contrasting mm-hmm. me with a Republican woman. And it's living in North Carolina, the pool of folks that think like I do or have similar values is fairly low.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to meet folks, especially with my time constraints. And I thought matchmaking would be a reasonable, as you would say, a reasonable experiment.
And so how has the experiment turned out for you?
I met some really cool women. In fact, I'm still in touch with one of them, but it's, and this is sort of what triggered the chapter. You know, women really don't know what they want,
mm-hmm.
because everyone that you meet through these, or I should say, I shouldn't make a generality like everyone, but the women I met, the majority of women I met through the matchmakers had no idea exactly what they wanted. They thought they wanted like a committed relationship, or that they wanted to travel, or that they wanted to meet a decent guy. They just didn't know themselves that well. And many times you just wouldn't, the whole date would fall apart. And then several times they would just back out after a couple of dates, and it was looking like it was headed towards commitment, which is what, when you sign up, evidently when you sign up for these matchmaking companies, especially as a woman, you fill out all these questionnaires, and they talk to you, and they screen you, and, you know, they make sure that you're looking for a commitment, or that you would move or migrate or do whatever in terms of dating.
Mm-hmm.
And once these women got into the actual dating pattern, that's not what they wanted at all. It's really funny.
Well, I think that that's a great lead into probably the title of the most, or let me rephrase that. I think it's a great lead into talking about the most controversial title.
You think? Yeah.
In the book. And that's chapter 4, All Women Are Prostitutes.
Right. And it's it was written somewhat tongue-in-cheek, trying to analyze, and like a cost-benefit analysis. When you get into the chapter, it's not exactly like the title itself.
Yeah.
But I kept the title, even in the face of heated animosity from a couple of my friends. In fact, a very good friend of mine who is an escort she decried that chapter title. She just hated it. Whereas some of the more suburban female friends were like, okay, I can see that. But she was very offended by it. I kept it anyway. but it's a controversial title designed to get attention.
Right.
And once you get into the chapter, it breaks down sort of the cost-benefit of first date, second date, third date versus going out with an escort, and showing why a lot of men go out with escorts,
mm-hmm.
Because it's a sure thing. They're usually beautiful. They're usually intelligent. And at the end of the night, you're getting what you paid for.
Yeah.
Whereas the other dating scenarios, the males will spend pretty much the same amount of money on some flighty female who may or may not be ready, willing, able, desirous of even a second date.
Right, right. Well, I have to tell you, I take a little bit of concern with the word flighty female, because not everyone you dated was flighty, I'm sure.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No. I wouldn't use the term flighty on with the majority of the women that I went out with.
Yeah.
That's it was far from the truth.
Okay. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting take on it, especially because so much of it was actually wrapped in the idea that there are societal expectations.
And there are societal expectations, and that's part of the thrust of the chapter itself. And you'll see that even further in the book. I mean, particularly with marriage. Marriage mm-hmm. basically, in many cases, just boils down to a business proposition. And same thing with dating.
Yeah. Well, you know, that really brings up the whole idea of control, right?
Because,
you know, one of the premises that you laid out in the book is that control ultimately causes the demise of relationships. Because once a partner has total control, what more can they get from the relationship? What more do they want? And you also say in a relationship, the one who holds the power is the person who cares the least.
Absolutely.
So how do you see control being channeled in a way that a relationship can survive instead of just the dismal picture of it's doomed to fail?
Because I don't think that control has a real place in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The woman that I'm seeing now always talks about neutrality and allowing in a relationship. And when you're in a relationship and you're utilizing control, that is not allowing the other person to express their individuality,
right,
or grow or become educated. And it also means that the other person, the one who's being controlled, is somehow, and I hate using the word subservient, but is allowing themselves to be controlled, which
mm-hmm.
they've already given up. And so once you even introduce one aspect of control into the relationship, then if the person who has the control actually starts utilizing more and more of it, then eventually they're going to have all the control and they're just going to have some puppet that no longer interests them.
Right, right. And I think that's a really incredibly valid point, because as human beings, you know, we have a desire to want to control our surroundings, to make ourselves feel safe, to make things predictable. Yet that doesn't really extend well to a committed relationship.
Absolutely. And it's one thing if, as a partnership, you guys decide to control your environment. That's perfectly okay. I mean, you're controlling your environment. You reach a decision together. You know, you want to do this, you want to do that. That's
mm-hmm.
fine. But it's when one person starts controlling the other.
Right. Right. So there's, you know, definitely a fine line as to where control is appropriate and where it's not. And gosh, you know, I'm looking at the time and we're already out of time, which is incredibly unfortunate, because there's so much more to talk about with your book.
There
it
is
really
indeed.
Is that complicated. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today, Dr. Rawlings.
Well, you're more than welcome. I appreciate being on the show.
Well, in case you'd like to learn more about It Really Is That Complicated and Dr. Charles Rawlings, the author, you can find out more about the book at www.itreallyisthatcomplicatedbook.com, and you can also pick it up at Amazon. Next time, I'll be having a conversation with image consultant Kay Smith.